Okay. So, few comments before we really start. So, first of all, there is a homework session today at 6 p.m. like last week. Second, I just want to tell you, before I go back to the computations of last time, so the goal for the next two classes are to get into path integrals in the context of knot theory, and we will do the first meaningful path integral in knot theory, and it will say that if you integrate over the space of all one forms on R3, so this is the symbol for path integrals, meaning meaningless integration, e to the exponential of a wedge dA integrated on R3, so it's the integral of e to the integral, and then multiplied by the integral along a curve gamma 1 of A, so you can, if you have a 1 form, you can integrate it along a curve, times the integral along a curve gamma 2 of A, then the result is the matrix element of the D in of the operator D inverted, computed between gamma 2 and gamma 1, whatever that means, which is the linking number of two curves. So this is sort of theorem zero in the overall there. If you wish, this is Monday is equal to Wednesday is equal to Friday. Okay? In the simplest possible context. It's completely barbaric, if you look at it. This is a combinatorial counting computable in linear time. This requires inverting a differential operator and integration. And this is even worse, because it's an integration over a meaningless infinite dimensional space. So it's completely going from the easy to the hard, but on the other hand, this will generalize in a rather easy way, and will inspire generalizations elsewhere, I mean, in the other places. Okay. But we're not there yet, because last time we didn't finish our task. So last time we were going, last Friday, we were going over this handout. Is there anybody who doesn't have a copy? If you wish, there are a few more over here. And let me remind you what we were doing. And again, the purpose of that handout was to just introduce path integrals. Okay? So we started with a question. The question was, solve Schrödinger's equation d psi dt is equal to a Hamiltonian times psi in the case where the Hamiltonian is the standard kinetic energy, so minus 1/2 the Laplacian, plus the potential energy for a pendulum or a harmonic oscillator, so 1/2 x squared, with some initial condition, psi at time t equals 0 is equal to psi 0, and because I knew the answer would be nice, I decided that I want to know the answer at pi over 2, which I should be reminded is equal to tau over 4. Anyway, and then we started solving it, and the solution is to, well, since this is a d psi dt is equal to a times psi, the solution is e to the a psi, e to the a t applied to psi 0. Okay? So, in other words, psi at time t is to exponentiate the Hamiltonian, evaluate it on psi 0, evaluate the result at x, and then since the Hamiltonian was the difference or the sum of two terms, we had to use the so-called Trotter lemma, which says that e to the exponential of a sum, sorry, e to the sum is the limit of e to the a over n times e to the b over n, all of this raised to the power n. And then, therefore, the previous thing becomes a composition of many, 2n simpler operators applied to psi 0. Then we said, let's evaluate these two simpler operators. So e to the I times the potential energy is just a multiplication operator. And e to the I times the kinetic energy is given by an integral kernel, convolution with a Gaussian at some time, okay, at some with some parameter. And then since we had a chain of multiplications and then convolutions, the answer becomes a multiple integral, very multiple, meaning integral, I mean 10 to the 58 times multiple, okay? In which you alternate between convolution and multiplication, convolution, multiplication. And then, alternatively, we could take all the integration variables in this 10 to the 58 integrals and think of them as forming a single path, or as defining the coordinates, or the coordinates of a polygonal path defined between time zero and time capital T, and then the integrand becomes Riemann sum approximation of a certain integral associated with this path. So the overall answer becomes a path integral, so this is this integral D, the path, times the integral from 0 to t of some quantity defined along each path, which is this, the so-called action, and we computed last time that it comes out to be this. I'm just reviewing, okay? And then, so in other words, what we seek to compute is the path integral over all paths as well. I mean, this is a review, so I'm skipping the conditions, but the boundary conditions. But we seek to compute the path integral over all paths with boundaries, with given boundaries, of e to the I times the Lagrangian at the action at a given path, where the action is given by this integral form. We said in general, integrals of exponentials are better studied by changing to coordinates in which the center is the place where the integrand is stationary. So basically, if you integrate the exponential of this, or e to the I times this, then you'll find that where it is sloped, the contribution to the integral is small because you'll get cancellations, so you want to concentrate near the center. You want to concentrate your attention to the places where the integral is stationary. And let's call this xc. This is, of course, in an infinite dimensional space, the space of paths. So let's call it xc, and then instead of a general point x, we will call it xc plus xq. So xq is the perturbation near the kind of critical point. Okay? And then we found that in the particular case where L is quadratic, L of xc plus xq is L of xc plus L of xq, and when you feed it into our path integrals that we wanted to do, we found that the original path integral is equal to e to the I times the classical action, so the L evaluated at the critical point, at the xc which minimizes L, times an integral which is independent of the boundary points, of the things we care about, of x0 and xn. So we call that infinite dimensional integral c, meaning a constant. Whatever it is, it's a constant. And therefore we get an answer which is, well, we at least get the dependence, the dependence of the answer on the boundary conditions, meaning on x0 and xn, which is what we wanted. Okay? And in fact, we will do exactly the same today in a slightly different context. Okay? Today or maybe tomorrow. I mean, in the process of studying this.
Is that C going to be like a finite C or?
The constant C. This C.
Space.
So it's better to call it a meaningless C.
Okay.
Okay. A C that so. Or how meaningful it is will depend on how... So, generally speaking, no, it's not finite, but sort of... It's not even clear that it has a meaning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the XC and the constant C, do they have any relation?
No, I made a mistake. I mean, I should have called, you know, X sub C here, it means the classical X.
I see.
So the X that minimizes the action. And this C just means constant. I should have used different letters. Okay? Sorry. Okay. But anyway, the question remains, how do we find X sub C? Okay? So, in other words, we have a Lagrangian, or an action principle, and it is the integral from 0 to t. So now x is a function. It's a function of one variable. And we associate the integral from 0 to t of, well, 1 half the second derivative of x minus v of x and t. V, in our case, is half x squared. But I may as well solve the problem in general. Okay? And the question is, how do we find, and we're looking for an X sub C which minimizes this with some given boundary conditions, meaning with X sub C equal to X0 at time 0 and to Xn at time capital T. And then the question is, how do we find the thing which minimizes this? So, basically, we have a functional which is defined on all paths that start at a given point and end at a given point. And the question is, how do we find the path that minimizes this functional among all paths? So it's an infinite dimensional minimization problem. So, I hope I'm not boring you, okay? But since we're so near something so wonderful, we should say something about it, even if it isn't the real point of this class, the critical point of this class. So, you know, just as an advertisement, the exact same problem occurs in a zillion other places. So, there is the Barkisto-Kron problem. Do you know what the Barkisto-Kron problem is? Barkisto-Kron. Okay, I know how to spell it. This is the correct spelling. Yeah. So, basically, you want to design a ski slope that starts at the lodge at the top and ends at the base camp, whatever it is, and that does it with maximal thrill. So you want it to be so that when you ski from top to bottom, you get there at maximum speed. Sorry, at minimal time. Okay, you get there as quickly as possible, so you'd be running as fast as possible. So, obviously you want to sort of start with a relatively high slope so that you'll be gaining speed quickly, but then at some point you must also cover the horizontal distance, so you cannot just let it be free fall. Okay? So which path is optimal? I'm assuming no friction. Okay? And the answer is, well, okay, it's a problem of the same type. You have among the space of all paths with given boundary conditions, for each path, you can compute how long it will take to slide around it. It turns out the output, the answer turns out to be an integral. And then among all the paths, we want to find the one that minimizes that integral. So that's example number one. Example number two of the same phenomena is the power line problem. The power line problem. So you have two, what do you call them? Power utility towers? I mean,
station.
Towers on which you hang power lines, right? And you hang an electrical power line in between, and then the question is, what shape will it take? And then the minimization problem is, among all paths that start here and start here, and actually also that have a certain fixed arc length, which one has the minimal potential energy? It will sort of tend to minimize, it will hang in a way that we need to minimize potential energy, and then the question is, what is this way? Okay? You know, over here, the answer is the so-called cycloid, whatever it is. Over here, the answer is that this is the graph of hyperbolic cosine, at least up to translation, and you know, with some choices of constants, okay? But basically, it's the graph of hyperbolic cosine. Let me give you another example before we go back to actually solving the problem. So, the next example is perhaps my favorite because I use it all the time, including now. So, you want to move a camera from pointing at one thing to pointing at another thing. And as you move the camera, the image moves, right? You can see that the image moves. So there is blur and on the screen, right? You get motion on the screen, and if the motion was too fast, you wouldn't be able to follow. So, you know, if I'll just move, you know, sort of, well, I mean, if I move too quickly, you will know, well, I cannot do it because my mouse is not responsive enough. But you will not be able to follow. So the question is, right, I have a picture in the plane, and I have a camera pointing at it at one place. I want to move it so that it would point at it in another place. And the question is, how do I best move the camera from one point to the other? Now, in what sense, what does best mean? So it can mean lots of things, but it turns out that all of them give the same answer, by the way. But roughly speaking, but here's one interpretation. So when I move the camera, here is my screen, the picture screen. On this screen, there is a vector field, because all points on the screen appear to move as the camera moves, right? You know, here the camera moved, but the appearance is that everything on the screen moved. Okay? So take the L2 norm of this vector field and then integrate it along along time and find the path that minimizes this. Which path is it? So straight line would be a bad idea because you'd be moving near the surface, so the apparent motion on the screen will be big. So it seems like it would be a nice idea to go up a little bit and then down, because basically to zoom out and then zoom in, because when you zoom out, you can move more quickly, you can move the camera faster, while the apparent motion on the screen will be slower. Okay? But what path exactly do you take? So, sorry, it's my favorite question, so I spent some time on it, and part of the reason why it's my favorite question is because these are the paths that are being used here. Oh, here's a good one, right? I zoom out, then I zoom in. Okay? So what's the answer? I guess the answer is hyperbolic geodesics. Hyperbolic geodesics. And if we're into geodesics, geodesics is a is yet another occurrence of the same problem. So we have a manifold and two points on it and a strange metric, I don't know, not a uniform metric. And we want to find the path that goes from here to here of shortest length. Again, it's a minimization in an infinite dimensional space problem. So how do we solve all of them? All of them are solved in the same way, and it's using the Euler-Lagrange equations. And, I forgot the most interesting one. Practically all of physics, or at least all of classical physics. All of classical physics, including the bits that we're doing right now. So anyway, how do we find this bit of classical physics? Okay, we do the following. We say we want the path x sub c that minimizes this functional. So if it minimizes this functional, then if we add to it epsilon times a perturbation, right, times some other path, then the end result should be quadratic in epsilon, not linear in epsilon. Right? The property of minimas is that if we move epsilon away, the result is quadratic in epsilon rather than linear in epsilon. The property of points where the derivative is not zero is that if we move epsilon away, the change in the output is proportional to epsilon with a non-zero proportionality constant. Okay? So I want to evaluate the action at the classical thing plus epsilon times a perturbation and hope that the result will have no term proportional to epsilon in it. Okay? Now, the perturbation, since I'm minimizing within all paths with some fixed boundary conditions, the perturbation must have zero boundary conditions, because I don't want to spoil the old boundary conditions. So I want to evaluate this at xc plus epsilon xq, where xq has zero boundary conditions. Well, let's look at this thing and compute the linear term in epsilon in it. The linear term in epsilon is what we want will be zero. Okay? So let's see. This is simply quadratic. The term, if I replace x by xc plus epsilon xq, the term linear in epsilon will be, well, right, basically you'll get xc times xc, xc times xq, and xq times xq, but the term linear in epsilon will be the xc times xq, so this term. And I hope the constants are right. Yes, they are, because there is a 1/2 and it should appear twice. Okay? And over here, if I replace x by xc plus epsilon xq, then by, I think it's maybe Taylor's theorem, or maybe the definition of the derivative, v of xc plus epsilon xq, the term proportional to epsilon in it is epsilon times v prime. Or epsilon times xq times v prime. So from here I get that. Okay? Now, the idea is to write this term, again, this is what we want will be equal to zero. We want to set this to zero. The idea is to write this as the inner product of something with xq. So this part looks good because it's Well, the inner product of V prime with X cube. Okay? But here we have X cube dot. So we use integration by parts to move the dot from this X cube to the XC. Okay? And exactly the same works in all the cases that I mentioned. Okay? So, using integration by parts, well, the second term remains the same, V prime of at XC times XQ, and the first term becomes negative XC double dot multiplied by XQ, and there are no boundary terms in this integration by parts because, well, the boundary terms will be XC dot times XQ at the boundary, but XQ is zero at the boundary. Okay? But now, this should be zero for every XQ. The only way an inner product can be zero for any XQ is if the thing you multiply it with is zero. So this vector in L2, or this function of one variable, must be vanish, must be identically equal to zero. So we find that negative XQ XC double dot negative V prime of XC is identically equal to zero, or X double dot is negative V prime. So, by the way, the same thing happens in general, or similar things happen in general, but in the particular case where V is potential energy, the derivative of potential energy is usually called force. And we found that the acceleration is equal to the force, and this is Newton's second law in the case where the mass is equal to 1, because we fix the mass to be 1. Okay? Okay. But anyway, in our particular case, it's a different, well, V was half x squared, so V prime is just, what's the derivative of half x? It's just x, right? So this becomes the equation x double prime is equal to negative xc. The solution of this equation is a constant times cosine plus another constant times sine. And but we also have boundary conditions that xc at 0 is x0 and xc at tau over 4 is xn. And well, okay.
You solve.
Are you okay? Did I waste your time? Well, I did waste your time, James, right? Sorry.
I wasn't going to say it.
Such is life. But that's the end of this particular story. Okay, and now back to... I'm going to waste your time more, James. Sorry.
It's okay.
Eva, can I erase this blackboard? No, but this one I can?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You think I can?
It's not clear. It's less obvious. So, James, who was it who said that sort of Gaussian integration is like the most important single computation in mathematics?
I've said that a number of times.
You did. No, but there is some famous,
I don't know,
it's attributed to somebody famous, and I don't remember.
I'm not sure who would have said that. I can't think of who said that off the top of my head.
But yet, most mathematicians don't know how to do it. So, let's fix that, or at least fix... You know. So, but why? Even in the example case, really we had the integral of the exponential of a quadratic. Okay, the quadratic was a quadratic in the path. But also in the direction where we're heading, the thing I will eventually want to analyze and find to be equal to the linking number is an integral over an infinite dimensional linear space, so the space of one forms on R3 is a linear space, of an exponential of something quadratic, right? This depends quadratically in A, the one form. If you multiply A by 7, the input here gets multiplied by 49. Okay? So this is quadratic. So it's the exponential of e to the I times something quadratic. And then it is multiplied by something which is linear in A and another thing which is linear in A. So generally speaking, we want to do the integral of e to the I times a quadratic times a polynomial. Okay, we want to learn how to do such things. Okay? We want to learn that in general, but we will start with the simplest and then gradually build up to understanding these in complete generality. So the first integral is the integral that every mathematician should know, and very few actually know how to, not very few, but surprisingly few actually know how to evaluate it. So the integral from minus infinity to infinity of the simplest possible quadratic times no polynomial. Okay? Right. So again, this is sort of number one in a chain of what will be, I don't know, 8 steps of generalization or so on until we get here. Okay. So let's compute this. The trick, so, and by the way, it's a unique example. I mean, it's a trick that I don't know, I haven't seen used, or not used elsewhere, or rarely used elsewhere, I don't know. So let's call it the answer I1. I don't know what it is yet, but let's call it I1. Okay? So, I1 squared is equal to the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the negative x squared over 2 dx times the same thing, but I may as well call it, change the dummy variable to y. So it's the integral from the integral over r of e to the minus y squared over 2 dy, right? And now I use inverse Fubini. So I have a product of integrals, I write it as an integral over a product space. So this is the integral over R2 of the variables x and y of the product of the integrand. So, but the product of exponentials is the exponential of a sum, so e to the minus x squared plus y squared over 2 dx dy. But this is a radially symmetric function, right? And this is sort of the miracle. Generally, the product of two functions will not be radially symmetric. But here it is. In this particular case, it is. So we can change to polar coordinates. So what do we get if we change to polar coordinates? We get the integral from 0 to infinity, so let's call the coordinate here r, so dr, times, well, the integrand, well, or the contribution from the to the integral from the kind of little annulus, which runs from r to r plus dr, right? Sorry for being a bit informal. You know, if you really want, you can just look up the statement about Jacobians, etc. But I mean, I'm just... Okay? So what's the contribution of this annulus? It's the area of this annulus times the value of the integrand. The area of the annulus, So the area of this annulus is dr times the length of the annulus, which is tau times tau times r, where tau is the thing which satisfy pi is equal to tau over 2. Okay? I don't know if I will remain consistent with calling tau, with using tau, but it just occurred to me that I should. Okay? So, so the answer here is tau, well, okay. This is the area of the annulus times the value of the integrand, which is this. But lovelily, I don't know if this is an English word, but this is a derivative, right? This is the derivative of, so okay, so we get tau times the primitive of this, and the primitive of this is negative e to the negative r squared over 2. I didn't put too many negatives, I hope it's right. Okay? Evaluated from 0 to infinity. And okay, at infinity this is e to the negative infinity, which is 0, and at 0 this is 1, with this minus it's minus 1, but since it's the lower boundary of integration it becomes plus 1, so this whole thing is 1, so we just get tau. Okay? And therefore the conclusion is that I1 is equal to what? To
root tau.
Right, so I1 squared was tau, so I1 is the square root of tau. And again, in most books it is written as the square root of 2 pi. Okay? Okay. 2. Well, I may as well generalize it to Rn. So, what's In? Which is the integral over Rn of e to the minus x squared over 2, but now x is to be considered as a vector, so dx, and this is just the Euclidean norm, so maybe, you know, if you wish, I can write norm, okay? Then, now by using Fubini, this is just the product of I1 n times, right? So this is I1 to the power n. So this is, what is it? Tau to the n over 2. Okay? And incidentally, so again, once we're near something pretty, I cannot resist telling you about it. Okay? So, incidentally, this already tells us something which is generally hard, which is how to compute the volume of the n-dimensional sphere. Well, I mean, again, sort of not so hard. I mean, like, one, if you're a first-year undergrad, you think it's infinitely hard. If you're a first-year graduate student, you think, oh, it's an easy exercise in integration, but you don't actually know how to do it. Okay? So here's one way to do it relatively painlessly. So the idea is, you see, I could have computed In, on the other hand, using the same technique, meaning you switch to polar coordinates in Rn. And just as here, the volume of an annulus came up, so the area of a sphere, of a circle came up, in general it will be the area of a sphere that will come up. Okay? So then you can deduce the area, so, but since you know the answer, you can deduce the area of a sphere, the volume of a sphere. So let's do it. So, again, it's definitely not really a part of this class, but on the other hand, it would be shameful not to do it. Okay? So, let me, okay, so let Vn denote volume of the, well, of the sphere Sn, which is actually a sphere inside Rn plus 1. Okay, the unit sphere inside Rn plus 1. So, what do I know? I know that n plus 1, so I need to do the computation in Rn plus 1, okay? Well, on one hand, it's equal to tau to the n plus 1 over 2, right? As written here, I mean, as computed here. On the other hand, it's the integral over r to the n plus 1, e to the minus norm of x over 2 dx, okay? Which is equal to the integral over 0 to infinity of, so I guess it's exactly the same picture, right? So I have the sphere of radius r, and I want to figure out the contribution to the integral coming from the shell that goes from r to r plus dr. And this contribution is the value of the function on this shell, meaning e to the negative r squared over 2 times the volume of the shell. The volume of the shell is the volume of the unit n-dimensional sphere, so Vn, but scaled with r, right? If I scale everything by a factor of r, the n-dimension, the volume of the n-dimensional sphere should scale by r to the n. So times r to the n, I hope I'm right, times... Wait, am I right?
I think that's fine, despite, I mean...
No, the volume of the one dimension. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. Times the width of the shell, so dr. Okay?
Is it n minus 1?
Oh, yeah, right, it is.
Because it's n minus 1 dimensional manifold.
No, because we are, it's an n dimensional manifold. I'm working in our r to the n plus 1. Sorry, okay. But I think this is right, okay? So this is equal to Vn times the integral of r to the n e to the minus r squared over 2 dr from 0 to infinity, and I have no idea how to compute this, so I will call it alpha n. I don't know, just temporary name. What do I know about alpha n? So first of all, alpha 0 is the integral from 0 to infinity of just r to the 0, so just 1, and of e to the minus r squared over 2, and that's just one half of the integral from minus infinity to infinity, and it is, and the integral from minus infinity to infinity was tau, sorry, square root of tau. So alpha 0 is one half square root of tau. Alpha 1 is, okay, alpha 1 is the integral of r times this, and this is now a complete derivative, in fact, the same complete derivative as before. So the answer is tau, I hope. Okay? And is this one I got?
Sorry, I thought this integral was 1.
No, it's 1. It's 1. Sorry, just 1. You're right, sorry. It's just 1. Okay? And now I can do the general case. So alpha n, not the general case, the recursion. Okay? So alpha n is the integral of r to the n e to the minus r squared over 2, What I can do is I can write it as the integral of r to the n minus 1 times r times e to the minus r squared over 2. And now I can do integration by parts. So I guess I'll call this u, and I'll call this v prime. And the result is uv evaluated from 0 to infinity minus the integral from 0 to infinity of u prime v. Am I right? I hope I haven't forgotten how to do integration by parts. Okay? So let's see. Here, u is this. Okay, so actually maybe I should write first of all what v is. So here v is negative e to the minus r squared over 2. Right? So let's see. U vanishes at 0. It explodes at infinity, but v converges to 0 even faster. So u times v vanishes on both boundaries. So this just becomes nothing. Here, the minus cancels the minus. So we just get the integral from 0 to infinity of the derivative of r n minus 1. So n minus 1 times r to the n minus 2. I hope I haven't forgotten how to do derivatives. Times v. So times minus v. So e to the minus r squared over 2. So, dr. So the result is just n minus 1 times alpha n minus 2. I hope I got it right. Okay? But now we can compute anything we want. I mean, just recursively. And in fact, sort of since the recursive thing is n minus 1, you'll just get the you can just write closed form answer in terms of factorials. I will not write the closed form answers in terms of factorials, but let's just do sanity checks. Okay? So, what's the volume of the zero-dimensional sphere? It is alpha 0 divided by alpha 0. No, it's tau to the 1/2 divided by alpha 0. Alpha 0 is 1/2 of tau to the 1 of tau to the 1/2. So v0 is equal to 2. And indeed, the volume of the zero-dimensional sphere is 2. It's just 2 points. Right? V1 is... it's not important, but I'm used to it. V1 is tau divided by alpha 1. Alpha 1 was computed here, so it's tau divided by 1, so it's tau. And indeed, this is the definition of tau. It's the length of a circle. Okay? And the last one, V2, the last one that I will actually do, is tau to the 3/2 divided by alpha 2. I suppose we should compute alpha 2. So alpha 2 is just 2 minus 1, so 1 times alpha 0. So it's tau to the 3 over 2 divided by alpha 0, which is 1/2 tau to the 1/2. So the answer is 2 tau, and 2 tau is often called 4 pi, and 4 pi is indeed the area of the sphere, and it continues. Okay? So I think we're out of time. But, you know, next time I will basically continue generalizing Gaussian integration more and more until we will compute the Gaussian integral we really wanted. Okay, see you on next Friday. And see you already this afternoon at 6:00.